Between worrying about his artist friends and reconciling his complicated feelings about New York City, Pulitzer finalist and Tony Award winner Richard Greenberg still finds time to be something of a hermit, and it seems to be working out for him. As a playwright, he says, the time spent alone making up stories about fictional characters has sharpened his sensitivity to real life and all of the bizarre, unpredictable, and even unimaginable people beyond one's front door. In his new book, Rules for Others to Live By, he shares stories from his life, observations from two decades of residence on a three-block stretch of New York City, and musings from his brilliant, if not a little unusual, mind, spanning a range of topics from friendship to writing, urban life to visiting parents, health crisis to hypochondria, and other paranoid tendencies. Richard Greenberg has written 24 plays, including the Tony Award-winning Take Me Out, which was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. His latest play, The Babylon Line, is in previews at the Newhouse Theater in Lincoln Center. It opens December 5th, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Richard Greenberg to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for asking.
Is it exciting when you have two big projects to talk about at the same time?
Yes. I'm doing better than I usually am. I typically come down with bronchitis at these moments, and I don't have it yet, knock wood.
How did the book come about in the sense of wanting to just kind of share some of these observances and yes, rules for others to live by?
My agent suggested I write it. I never had any idea of writing a book of essays, certainly not personal essays, because I'm not especially confiding. Then I thought about it and became more attractive to me, and finally I figured out a way to do it where I could trick myself into thinking that I was remaining private while revealing stuff. And it turned out to be really a lot of fun and incredibly natural, because it turned out that what I really do all day in my apartment is just write essays in the form of conversations with myself.
Right.
And so now it's just writing them down. And I think it's been a boon to my mental health, because when you just walk around your apartment all day talking to yourself, you're insane. And when you write them down, you're an author.
I love you using the word confiding, and I'm curious as to, in the plays that you've written, do you feel you're more confiding, or there is a sense of that in much of your work?
You know, the thing about the plays, they're all ventriloquism, you know? And that's, there's
right.
Something so much easier, because it feels so safe, because everyone has a pseudonym, and because you can permeate all the characters, even though I think people tend to identify one character as the author in most plays, or in any play where that's possible. But you can kind of equally distribute yourself. So, yeah, it's all a form of doing that while feeling safe about doing that, for me.
Writing these particular essays, and the subtitle being Comments and Self-Contradictions, these are things that strike you, and they don't have to necessarily make sense, because they make sense to you.
I would say they all make sense to me in the moment, but I feel I'm marked by misgiving. Do you know? That's my mode. So I can feel very, very strong and fiery about something for a while, and then I can rethink it later. So it really, it's a collection of ambivalent essays, really.
And that ambivalence is comes through certainly in the essays, but it does seem that you have strong points on certain things. I mean, you feel very strongly about certain things.
Yes, incredibly so. Actually, pretty late in the book, there's an essay called Opinions, where I acknowledge that I've given up having them. And in a way, it's good that that came late, or I don't think I would have been able to write the book. Because I've just, maybe it's an age thing. I've just come to a point where I think it's okay for me to feel as I do about things without mistaking my feelings for universal laws. Do you know? So I guess that's where the ambivalence comes from. It's you can be very, very strong and very, very and full of conviction and realize, well, it may not apply to others, which I guess is sort of would suggest that I'm ambivalent even about the title of my book.
You say in that opinion chapter, I did mark this, the truth about opinions is that they are seldom impartial. In fact, they are seldom opinions. They are many other things, attempts to equalize, preemptive strikes, psychological hedges.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm in the arts. So,
so that explains it.
So that explains that.
Does it make you, do you think, because you, I mean, you have a great thing in here about, yes, hypochondria and so forth.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think it makes you, do you really consider yourself to be closed and a hermit and never getting out? Or do you feel that your life goes beyond that three block stretch?
Well, you know what the thing is, and this is part of, you know, when I was, after I finished this book and when people would ask about it, I found myself talking about myself in the third person as if I were Norman Mailer or Jerry Lewis. Do you know what I mean? It was he. Do you know what I mean? It was he. And I just thought, I never imagined I would be one of those people, but I'd been able to create that sort of psychological barrier that enabled me to talk more freely than I would by nature. But it also allowed me to exaggerate certain points. Do you know? And
yes.
So that's one of the things that I'm exaggerating, the hermeticism. What did happen, though, is somewhere, I think, like in 2009, I kept having these small but strong kind of ailments, and it was one after another, and I found myself spending a lot of time on my sofa at that point, because it seemed every time I went out, I'd get something. And that's when it went where I sort of learned to be inside an awful lot. But no, I don't... you know, I'm in the world. I'm in life. I go out. I go to work. I go to rehearsals. I see people.
Let's talk a little bit about rehearsals and about the Babylon Line. For those for our listeners who are many may be familiar with this, having seen it at a Powerhouse. I know we talked to Josh Radner when the show was around, and we were and it was the very beginning stages. So here you are with Josh ready to work on this, preview it, and open it on the 5th of December. How is it feeling as you start this preview process?
You know, it's been feeling wonderful, and I'm not superstitious, and yet I used to be. So to say that terrifies me. But it's been really a kind of wonderful process. I hate that word. But it's been a wonderful time working on this. The cast is, you know, the thing is, if I tell you the truth, it's going to sound as if I'm lying. But they really are just kind of wonderful and get along beautifully, and it's been... what you hope for.
And just a little thumbnail sketch of what the play is about, but it is it takes place in Levittown, and it's the first night of a creative writing class. Josh Radner is the teacher, and it's basically the relationship within three women who are students in that class.
Well, it takes place, it starts in 1967 and then kind of vaults forward, which might be a spoiler, I'm not sure to say that. Yes, it, you know, it's a return to the suburbs. I grew up in the suburbs, and I've never felt that the way they're reflected in films reflects my experience of them or in television. Do you know what I mean? I just don't feel
right.
Yeah, I've never quite seen it, so I figured, well, why not write it?
You didn't grow up in Levittown. You did grow up on Long Island, and I guess what is common, the commonality there, is that you're 45 minutes from New York City.
I am. I also grew up a minute from Levittown, depending on whether the light was red or green. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was walking distance.
Yeah. And did that place kind of fascinate you as
well? Levittown did. You know, Levittown is a fascinating idea because, you know, it was so widely derided in the culture, and it was meant to be the emblem. problem of our dastardly conformity. But what's so interesting is by the time I saw it, it was very difficult to find the original model of those houses or any two houses that looked alike. So they were sort of starter kits, and people expanded on them as they wished. So it was really one of the more diverse neighborhoods in the area, at least architecturally. Culturally, no.
I've heard you say that when you were a kid, you always thought it was a little odd, a little weird, that people were friends because of proximity.
It's true. Yeah, I did. It was just something that struck me sometime when I was, a pre-adolescent, adolescent, 11 or something. It just occurred to me that because back then, and maybe it's the same now, I haven't lived in the suburbs for a while, people really were neighborly, and they were constantly meeting and clutching, and they were watching each other's vacation movies and all of that. And at a certain point, I thought, so wait, you are all friends because you happen to live next door. That's peculiar. And yet, I later, when I went to college, learned that there was some sort of social psychology study that showed that people were much more likely to marry people who lived near them than people who lived far away. And I remember thinking, this study was funded. But but of course you become friends with the people who are given to you. But it did seem peculiar that that kind of intimacy developed because of the accident of purchasing homes side by side.
People talk about your work, and I think it's interesting in this play, as well as Our Mother's Brief Affair and The Assembled Parties, having these very strong, wonderful roles for women, in middle-aged women in their 40s or older.
Yeah.
And how conscious is that for you?
It's not at all. It's certainly not a program I've set out on. I just, I'm friends with lots of women, and I find them really interesting. So I write them. I think it's as simple as that. I just, they're interesting, and I've always found them. When I was, this is odd, but I was a dramatics camp counselor for 1 month at a day camp when I was 19. And it was so striking because they took very young kids, and it seemed that the girls were so complicated so early, and the boys were not at all. The boys, you gave them a ball, they were happy. And the girls, you said hello, and you could see that they were trying to figure out what you really meant. And I guess it sort of stayed that way for me. I just find women really interesting to talk to and write about.
But even at 19, it seems fascinating to me about you that you would have paid close attention to the responses of the girls and the women in that situation.
Well, you couldn't miss it. Miss it. That you. I remember there was this group of 5.5- and 6-year-old boys who were the cutest people I've ever known because they had everything that was good about maleness and nothing that was bad about it. Do you know what I mean? This kind of life-grasping enthusiasm and it was great, but they were quite simple. They were quite simple. Where the girls, you just had to be very, very careful with, because they seem to take things from you on a different level.
Well, you've got a lot of new stuff to talk about. Rules for Others to Live By is the book. Comments and Self-Contradictions, that is out and published by Blue Rider Press. The Babylon Line is in previews now. It opens December 5th at the Newhouse Theater at Lincoln Center, directed by Terry Kinney. Richard Greenberger, great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very, very much for sharing your time, and best of luck on all of the projects.
Well, thanks so much.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Rules for Others to Live By is now out. It's published by Blue Rider Press, and The Babylon Line opens December 5th, now in previews, and you can find out more information by going to lct.org, lct.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.